I'd like to thank the organizers for inviting me to talk here. First, I'd like to apologize. I won't say much about spin chains here, in fact, next to nothing. I've decided that...
Get your hold of me.
How do you turn this on?
The red button? The red button?
Okay. Decided that given the talks here, I would sort of adapt my talk and give a slightly different talk than I intended to. But I hope to get to what I was originally going to speak about towards the end. So, first of all, I also apologize because my talk will have nothing to do with quantum chaos. In fact, it will be all about integrable systems. In particular, I want to start with, let me start with the definitions and what have you. And I want to give a little bit of an overview about what is known in the integrable case about eigenfunction, eigenvalue estimates.
What's this?
That's okay. Yeah. Okay. So, throughout the talk, X is going to be a compact C-infinity manifold, and I consider H1 hat a self-adjoint elliptic superfinite operator. That's my quantum Hamiltonian, and the hat just means that I quantize a given classical Hamiltonian, H1. So I take op of H1. So, for example, you may as well think of just the metric squared here, and I quantize it by just taking the Laplace operator. And so, the definition here is just the following. So I say that the classical Hamiltonian H1 is completely integrable if there exist additional functions H2 through Hn. Let's take them smooth. Such that they Poisson commute. So, the HIs and this is not focused now, is it? Is it okay? The HI is Poisson commute, and I assume that the differentials are independent on a dense open subset of a cotangent bundle. So that's the standard definition of classical integrability. Quantum integrability, you take op of H1, and that will be my quantum Hamiltonian. And I say the system is quantum completely integrable. I'll simply say QCI from now on. Provided the operators commute. So all the operators pairwise commute. And I'm going to let psi sub k going from k1 to infinity be an orthonormal basis of joint eigenfunctions. Okay?
Ignorance.
I'm just giving a whole list of examples. Okay. So here's a very incomplete list. Flat tori, everyone knows. Surfaces of revolution, Liouville tori spheres, geodesic flow on hyper ellipsoids in any dimension. That's important for the purpose of this talk. A lot of these things occur in families that occur in any dimension. All right, so they come in huge lumps. Families of left invariant metrics on Lie groups. The article by Tim on this is classified. Neumann, if you look at inhomogeneous situation, you have lots of others. Neumann oscillators, Russell-Cadis oscillators, Kovalevs, quantum Kovalevsky top. These are all quantum systems. Legendre, Euler tops. This is due to, Heckman proved this about 10 years ago, that they were quantum integrable, the Kovalevsky tops and all these things. Lamé harmonics, which is what I'll talk about later in the talk, and the list continues. I mean, it's a long list. Heisenberg manifolds, although we don't understand the quantum picture there completely yet. So this is a very incomplete list, but obviously very exceptional.
You'll explain it to us. What it looks like.
It's up here, right?
You're going to go into that one in detail?
Well, the Lemmy harmonics are very similar. Very, very similar. Both from the quantum and the classical.
Even the classical ability there is.
There's a Jacobi, I got lost track of which one I'm using now. That one's. All right.
Back to my question. What are interesting examples of completely integrable systems which are not quantum computing?
Don't know any. That's purely an empirical observation, but don't know any. Heisenberg is an interesting case because we don't know what quantum integrability means in that case, but I think it's quantum integrable actually in the category for integral operators. I think the third integral quanta, it's not a differential operator, it's not even pseudo-differential. I think it's one of these half-half symbols, but that's pure conjecture. So let me give sort of some of the basics of what are known in the semi-classical about eigenfunctions and eigenvalues in the semi-classical regime first. So, I mean, as everyone knows, most of the cotangent bundle is foliated by Lagrangian tori. I'll call those lambda sub e. E denotes a vector. Those are the joint energy levels of H1 and through Hn. So the picture is, I mean, you know, you think of a harmonic oscillator. You have mostly circles for the level sets. So if I take one of these regular level sets, meaning the tori, the level sets, and the basic result here is a correspondence principle, which is the analog of quantum ergodicity, except in this case the level sets are much smaller, the Lagrangian tori. And this is due to Zeldich in the homogeneous case and Helfer-Robert in the semi-classical case, and other people prove various versions of this. But basically, you take an observable, let's say, a zeroth order symbol, so bounded function, and just a smooth function on the manifold, if you like. And then we can find an L2 normalized joint eigenfunction, so of H1 hat through Hn. It's a subsequence, a very thin subsequence, but you can find it. So I said if I take op q, psi k, comma psi k, the E just denotes the particular energy levels that I'm looking at. I get the integral of q over the torus with respect to the angle variables, and then I get an O of 1 over lambda error term. So that's the basic starting point. So in one dimension, this goes back to Einstein and maybe even earlier. But in the general integrable case, this is not that old in the results. Maybe 20 years, probably less.
Result of Einstein you refer to?
It's not a result. Well, I mean, it's the Einstein, it's the WKB theory. So
I thought that was the his point was the multidimensional.
That's what I mean.
I think you meant the multi.
That's what I mean earlier, right? I mean,
but he wanted to quote Einstein.
One
doesn't get off.
I wanted to quote Einstein. But here's my point. Here's my point here, though, that there are very nasty places where this is no longer the case. There's no longer this torus foliation. And in fact, we proved with Steve a rather easy proof that, in fact, the flat torus is the only case where you don't have degeneracies. Generically, for instance, if you take the case of the ellipsoid, these singularities can be rather complicated. The picture you get, and this is purely schematic, I can't draw it, but a level set is critical if the differentials are no longer independent. I mean, notice I said there was an open dense set, but what about the exceptional pieces? So schematically, you think of it as follows. The red dots correspond to tori, a compact tori of various dimensions. And they can go from anywhere to 1, from just geodesics to n minus 1, less than n, so n minus 1 dimensional compact tori. And these red curves denote cylinders. So the singular levels consist of compact torus orbits and cylinders. And they're interconnected like this. It turns out there's a correspondence principle for the singular leaves as well. And I proved this actually in 1998. I should point out that, first let me state something about the eigenvalues. There are still singular Bohr-Sommerfeld rules for the eigenvalues that were proved by that were given by Helfer and Schustrand in the analytic case, Colin de Verdier Paris, Colin de Verdier and Saint Vunac in the general case. They're rather complicated, but they are explicit, at least up to dimension. I think in higher dimension two, it's not actually been written down yet, but in principle, it's doable. Now, what we did with Steve Zeldish was look at blow-up of eigenfunctions. So it turns out that basically the difference between the integrable and the non-integrable case is that even though you have singular levels like this, and a priori all you know is that the eigenfunctions localize in some neighborhood of this singular mess. What you can prove is that, in fact, there has to be eigenfunction mass at each one of these red dots. Now, we don't know that the eigenfunction mass is not going to zero. It may actually be going to zero at all these red dots, but it does not go to zero any faster than power of logarithm, essentially. So it can be actually going to zero, but it does not go to zero too fast. And that's of course a very important point. That allows us to.
Let the near flat loss, you're saying blow up of eigenfunctions.
Yeah, I'll state more about it.
Oh.
Yeah, this
near
is.
Near torus. I don't know what that means. Disturbing a torus.
I don't know. I'll make that more precise. There, yeah. Well, maybe I'll put it here, then I'll just write it. Let me state the result. So gamma 1 through gamma m will be a finite collection of those red dots. These are these compact.
Is this still in a completely integrable setting?
Yes, but on a singular leaf. So gamma 1 through gamma m are these red dots. They're these compact orbits that occur on the singular leaf. And what we prove is that there are eigenfunctions that blow up along these orbits, and we give estimates for it. We give lower bounds, and they're sharp. The theorem simply says the following. So we take these compact orbits on the singular leaf, and we let L be the minimum of the dimension. Okay? Then we can find L to normalized eigenfunctions such that for any epsilon, the L infinity norms blow up like this, and the LP norms blow up like this power here. Now, if you put epsilon equal to zero, it's exactly what you would get, for instance, in the case of an equator, a surface of revolution. And I'm quite confident that we can actually put epsilon equal to zero, but we introduce a power of log, and we cannot get rid of that power of log. So what I am quite confident, the sharp result, is lambda to the kn minus L divided by 8 divided by log lambda to a certain power, which we can actually compute. And you cannot get rid of that log lambda. And these results are sharp. The main idea, number one is that, in fact, we have to show that a priori there exists enough mass, at least logarithmically enough mass around these compact orbits. And the second idea is to essentially localize on scales of h bar to the 1/2 around these compact orbits and show that there is, in fact, still essentially logarithmic mass, even shrinking tubes of that size. We pull out the volume, and that proves our result, essentially. I suppose the analytic tool is the use of quantum Birkhoff normal forms. I won't maybe say too much about that. You reduce then the computation to estimating small scale masses of model eigenfunctions.
You have an upper bound, which is the same.
A lower bound.
No, you said they essentially.
You have an upper bound, yeah.
Which is the same exponent.
Yes.
What?
well, I mean, take for instance the surface of revolution, right? If you take the equatorial orbit, you have eigenfunctions that blow up like lambda to the 1/8, which is what this gets.
But are you also claiming a theorem that any eigenfunction at all has that upper bound? I mean, is there a bound on the other side? You have a sequence which have blow up at this rate. Is there, on the other hand, an upper bound? What's the worst it can be?
I'll get to that in a second. Okay, the worst can be much worse. Worse can be much worse. So these are lower bounds, the blow-up rates associated to orbits, to compact orbits, always on the singular leaf. So let me get to the worst case. The worst case is actually the following. So we also have results on maximal blow-up of eigenfunctions.
Lambda squared is what I call lambda, right? What's the eigenvalue, lambda or lambda?
Lambda,
squared?
Lambda. Okay, so this is very big. This is very big. So it's almost the maximum allowable except for the log.
Okay.
This is in dimension 2, and this is a preprint, but we have the result. And the result occurs at recurrent points. So recurrent points... take this thing. Now what we show is that we can find a subsequent. If you have a recurrent point, a recurrent point is just a point where if you start a geodesic from the point, you always come back. You need not close up. For example, if you take the case of the ellipsoid with distinct axes, there are four umbilic points. If you start here, you go through the opposite one, you always come back. You never close up. The only periodic orbit going through these four points is this hyperbolic geodesic, which is the thing that you intersect with the one of the planes. If you're at a recurrent point, so if you have this exact focusing property, then in dimension 2, and you're always quantum completely integrable, then you can find a subsequence with L infinity blowing up like lambda to the 1/4 divided by log lambda, and it blows up at that point. And you cannot get rid of the log lambda, except by a theorem of Zeldich and Sog in the case where you're essentially sphere. So you can and you do get very bad blow-up. It's zonal harmonics.
You get lambda to the quarter.
You get lambda to the quarter. But that's the only case, essentially, in dimension 2.
But so for every ellipsoid, this
yes.
No matter how you choose ABC.
Doesn't matter. And it's also true for Lemé harmonics, by the way. Because Lemé harmonics, even though the Hamiltonian is just the standard metric on the sphere, the commuting operator is not second-order differential operator. And if you look at the geodesic flow for the commuting operator, which you might as well, it doesn't matter, it has exactly this property on the sphere. You have four points on the sphere, and they're recurrent, and you blow up exactly this rate.
In this situation, so you know that there are no multiplicities.
Do we know if there are any multiplicities? I don't know if there are any multiplicities, but I do not expect that there are.
This is not a feature of multiplicity.
No, because you can choose any A, B, and C any way you like.
Irrational.
Yeah, anything.
You want to avoid the sphere, but why? What happens if A is equal to B?
I didn't say. Then you don't have recurrent points. Then you have a surface of revolution, and then lambda to the 1/8 is the best.
Okay.
It's a different picture.
Oh, I see.
The asymmetry creates this... It's very classical, but it's true.
It seems to come from.
All distinct is very different from where two are equal. It's not a surface of revolution. It's okay, so. I get to what I wanted to talk about. I wanted to say these things so that we have at least I thought it would be useful given the audience. I also want to point out that everything I've talked about here is semi-classical, and Dima Jacobson was talking about semi-classical asymptotics. And as I mentioned a few minutes ago, many of these integrable systems come in families that do not depend on, they just come in higher dimensional families. In other words, ellipsoids are a good example. Lemé harmonics, the list goes on and on. They come in arbitrary dimension. And so it seemed interesting to me to try and study the dimensional asymptotics of eigenfunctions. And so what I'm going to talk about is joint work with Alain Bourget, Dima Jacobson, and Minou. And we picked the case of Lemay harmonics because I think, I mean, they're qualitatively, as I say, both from the quantum mechanical and the classical mechanical point of view, very similar to, for example, ellipsoids. They have all the properties. They have these rather complicated singularities. I think they're a good toy model to understand. And so we study the asymptotics. And in particular, I'm interested in large n asymptotics of the eigenfunctions. And in particular, at the moment at least, in large n behavior of the nodal sets. And the interesting thing is that when you are dealing with large n asymptotics, you might as well look at low spectra. You can look at actually spherical harmonics of low degree, degree 4, let's say, and just trace to see what happens to the nodal set in large n. You create asymptotics. So you can just look at low-lying eigenfunctions, and there are actually some interesting things that happen. And they all stem from the Heine-Stieltjes theorem that Dima mentioned earlier. So let me write down what these things are. So I'm going to fix these alphas. Again, if I were going to talk about the spin chain formulation, there would be sites. But let's just think of them as numbers on the real line between 0 and 1. The differential operators can be written in Euclidean coordinates like this. So this is a Laplacian written in x in the Euclidean coordinates. These are the commuting operators. So what this means is I take the alpha 0 through alpha n, I delete the I and j, form the mth elementary symmetric polynomial in the remaining alphas, and I put them in as coefficients like this. They commute, and the joint eigenfunctions are the Lemay harmonics. And this is independent of dimension. I can let n be anything here. And so what I'm interested in is the behavior of the nodal sets, for instance. Let's say you take the fourth eigenfunction, okay, the fourth Lemay harmonic, fourth degree Lemay harmonics. See what happens as n goes to infinity.
Is there some general construction? What are all the integrals? Are these the only integrals of commuting second degree operators?
Oh, no. There are lots and lots and lots. This is just one family. This actually comes from, well, no.
The classifications?
There's some of them. I mean, they're. I mean, is it completely understood? No, I don't think so. But they're large families. This is just one very small. Okay. Yeah, you have the Laplacian comes from a Casimir, and these things come from some other high SON plus 1 or something.
Yeah, I mean, this could be done for all symmetric spaces like this.
Absolutely. This is just the toy model that I work with because it has the characteristics of all of these. So as one can check the commute, they're elliptic second order differential operators. They're all second order. P0 is just the standard Laplacian on the n-sphere. And, this is where the only time I'll mention Godin. The system is a special case of what is called
the
Godin.
It's the same Gaussian random matrix.
Yeah, exactly. It's a special case of a Godin system. It corresponds to a specific choice of highest weights. But anyway, as far as the analysis goes, I don't think it actually, what we can or cannot do in this case, we can or cannot do in the general case. So I'm interested in determining the asymptotics of the zeros as n goes to infinity. I call that the large n limit. And again, for most of what I say, one can just think of a low-lying eigenfunction. I take a fourth degree Lemay harmonic and I try to understand its nodal sets actually on the spheres on Sn as n goes to infinity. Well, the main simplification, although it's still a difficult problem, the main simplification comes from introducing elliptic coordinates on the n-sphere. Because, as Dima mentioned, in terms of those coordinates, you separate variables. So you can write the joint eigenfunctions, which I'll call psi sub k, as a product of the Y sub K. So these are these Lemé polynomials or Heine-Stieltjes polynomials. And the nodal set on the sphere is just, well, it's just the sphere intersected with these cones with elliptic cross-section. And the eccentricities of the cones are determined by thetas. The thetas are the zeros of these polynomials. So let me start with some simple results, but I think they're kind of, well. So the first results are sort of essentially combinatorial. I mean, they are combinatorial. So we'll let lambda sub n be this polytope sitting inside the cube. So we assume that all the alphas are increasing, and they're between 0 and 1. Then recall from the Heine-Stieltjes theorem. So precisely this many Heine-Stieltjes polynomials, sigma nk, and the zeros theta 1 through theta k. So we're going to let, suppose degree k is fixed for the moment. Okay. So think of k as just being 5, 6, 7, whatever. Right? And there are precisely this many polynomials, and the zeros occur in every possible configuration relative to the alphas, and they occur precisely once. So the notation I use here is I'll let L, the vector L, denote a configuration. It'll be L1 through LK. LJ just denotes the number of the interval, so the labeling of the interval containing the jth zero, the interval of the alphas. So the first theorem, this is just an observation from the Heine-Stieltjes theorem, that you have actually, as n goes to infinity, a rather interesting asymptotics for the zeros. You behave as if you had a random process, a random Poisson process. If you take the levels, this is an average level spacings measure that I'll define in a minute. Phi is a test function on the unit interval, and if I let k be little o of n, and in this case I assume k goes to infinity too, but it does so in a relatively tame way.
I assume you always estimate k.
No, not for that, yeah. For level spacings you do.
But what happens if I just think of ordinary harmonics, I take the constant function, you're not going to get anything from that, or the next one will be just the coordinate function. Nothing going on. So
yeah, but you're letting n go to infinity. You're changing your manifold.
But even so,
you have to let k go to infinity.
You have to let k. For level spacings, you do. Yes.
For anything.
No.
K equals 4 is already interesting for something.
No. For density of states. For density of states, for instance, it's you don't need to let k go to infinity. Yes. But for level spacing,
you're keeping away from ordinary harmonics. There's some randomness built in these Lemé with different.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. So what's happening is that if you take a test function, a continuous function unit interval, k is little o of n, but both of them go to infinity, then the level spacings distribution tends to Poisson with this kind of error term. And what do I mean by that level spacing? I have to average over all configurations to create the randomness. So.
And the O1 over K is what forces K.
Exactly. So there's the average thing. So I rescale to mean spacing 1, and then I average over the kth degree configurations. However, if you're willing to deal with density of zeros, you need not let K go to infinity. Well, here are the results. I can only get this result in variance. I can't prove it point-wise for the alphas, but we do have a variance result. In the case of densities, density of zeros, well, I mean, you get uniform distribution, which is, of course, consistent with that, but you do get point-wise results. And if you just look at the average density, you need not let k go to infinity. If you look at just the standard density for any particular polynomial, you do have to let k go to infinity. You get sort of comparable results that are consistent with the Poisson level spacing.
I'm slightly confused. Why are you only testing in the unit interval?
Because the zeros all have to lie in the unit interval. That's by convexity.
Why is then the Poisson a natural?
It's not natural. It's surprising.
Surprising. Okay, then I'm.
It's not at all natural. If you do the semi-classical asymptotics, you don't get Poisson. You get WKB theory. So it's this is saying that somehow in the large n limit, these integrable zeros are behaving somehow, at least in these coordinates. as if they were random. That's kind of a weird thing, but it's very much the difference between large N and large K limits. I'm just beginning to sort of understand this.
Just because it's not a probability measure on zero.
E to the minus K? E to the minus X, rather. Mm-hmm. Oh, okay, there's a normalization, yeah, that's right. So you have to normalize by whatever. Yeah, there's a normalized. There's a bar there. The E.
Yeah, slash on the E.
Put the slash on it, yeah. So there's a slash here, okay. Okay. So I suppose the main point here is that for large N, the zeros seem to behave like random variables on the unit interval. And this is very different from the semi-classical limit. But these are essentially combinatorial results. They follow strictly from the combinatorics of the Heine-Stieltjes theorem. I've not used the critical point equations at all. So what I'd want to do in the remainder of my talk is to discuss sort of work in progress on actually going past the combinatorics. And the problem that I'm really interested in is the distribution of the zero set on the actual spheres. So you take the fourth degree Lemay harmonic, and for each n, and you look at large n, and you see how
that was what I was asking. So if you take the zero order harmonic, the constant function, you're not going to see anything.
Yeah.
If you take the first one, you're not going to see anything.
No, you might.
I will. Okay.
Yeah, you might. Well, there is no
first one. There's high multiplicity.
Well,
there are second.
They're very high multiplicity.
So
here's the point is that you have very high multiplicity. So what I'm going to do is I'm actually going to write down all the nodal sets for each second degree Lemay harmonic and plop them down on the sphere and try and
together.
Yeah, because they're large multiplicities. That's the thing. They're large multiplicities. So the zeros of the Lemay polynomials that index these nodal sets and these elliptic coordinates are given by critical points of this logarithmic potential. So this is the usual pairwise interaction term. And this means that the xi's are interacting with all of the fixed alphas with a logarithmic logarithmic potential, inverse distance force. Yeah. So from now on, I'm just going to put the alphas to be equidistributed. So I just make them essentially 1 over n, 2 over n, 3 over n, 4 over n. I'll put them evenly on the interval. You can choose the alphas here to be distributed in any regular way relative to Lebesgue measure. The results are essentially the same. So, I formed the partition function. So in order to understand the geometric distribution of the nodal sets in high dimension, what I have to understand are the large correlations of the zeros. And obviously combinatorics is not enough for this. So to do this, I form a Laplace integral. So I take a test function, let's say compactly supported smooth function on the unit cube and k variables. Let's say I'm interested in the kth degree Lemay harmonics. Okay, and I form this function. This integral, rather. So I integrate over the cube, 0, 1, and I put here e to the beta times omega n. Omega n is just the logarithmic potential, the critical points of the zeros. Beta will be a large parameter that I have to put in just to make the asymptotics work. It comes out in the end. So I choose it. You can choose it to be like n to the epsilon for any small epsilon. Right? So here's the thing. The integral is symmetric. Well, I mean, put f equal to 1. Okay, so the integral is symmetric. So really, all I have to look at is the particular positive chamber in the x coordinates. But let's look at the cube. So I split the cube up using the alphas into subcubes. What I know from the Heine-Stieltjes theorem is that essentially there's a 1, 0 vector. So each of these points denotes a k vector. of that gives you all the zeros for a given Lemay harmonic. And what I know is that there's precisely one red dot in each of these boxes. And so there's two things I can do. Well, the only thing I can do to begin with is to try and apply steepest descent. So the thing I use is that if you compute the Hessian of omega n by the Gersh-Gorin theorem, it's negative definite. You can actually get estimates on the eigenvalues. And, well, as you would expect, in fact, this is a proof of the Heinisch-Dilthus theorem. There's precisely one critical point in each box. It's concave. It's got a local maximum in each box. So I write down the expansion. Well, if you just write down, how much time do I have?
5 minutes.
Oops. Okay. So I write down the expansion. I get this. This is where I need the beta just to make. I'm writing squiggle. You can write down precise error terms. You have to be a little careful. You have to do these cutoff functions in the right way. But essentially, you get this. On the other hand, suppose that one could actually approximate this Laplace integral by replacing omega, the actual potential, by its mean field approximation, essentially, right? So we write this down. It's just this function here. It's a logarithmic integral. Well, I mean, one has to work a little bit, but in fact, so the logarithmic potential has very sharp peaks at 0 and 1. This means essentially that the configuration, think of if you have two points, think of k equals 2. The configuration where one zero is in the one extremal box and the other zero is in the other extremal box gives you the maximal energy. That's what this sort of corresponds to. And, well, I'm not going to obviously give any details, but one can actually make this rigorous. One can actually show that, at least at the level of entropy, the level of logs, the log of this integral is equal to the log of the mean field approximation, meaning where you replace the external potential by n times by this function here. And as a result, you reduce the computing to the mean field thing. This is fairly straightforward. If you write it down, I believe I have the right powers. You get this. And so the log of the thing that you were starting, oh, I forgot the f, so put f equal to 1 here. Okay. You just get minus n beta k plus o beta log n beta. And so if you, so that's sort of part one, and one can replace this density by any regular density relative. You can assume that the alphas are distributed with any regular density relative to the alphas. But the point is that one can localize this calculation to any box, essentially. And really, the box that seems the most important is the extremal vertex. So I drew the upper half. This is when k equals 2. So I drew the upper half of the cube. And it's this vertex that contributes the most to the configuration. That's the vertex where you have an extremal configuration. You can do this for any k. And these ones contribute, and you get a contribution coming with a certain Laguerre-Selberg integral appearing. And the point is that one can actually do a very local calculation here in the A sector to find out what the local partition function actually is. And that means that, and one can do similar calculations for all the other boxes, but you get much lower terms. And let me just say that if L is an extremal configuration, I don't want to define that, but in general, but in the case where k equals 2, that's exactly what it means. One point in one interval, one in the other. You get an asymptotic formula for log of omega. These are the large correlations that I want to look at. I want to see how the zeros are correlated with one another and how they're correlated with the fixed sites. And you get minus kn plus O of log n. The betas scale out in the end. So when k equals 2, I just wrote down. The extremal configuration is when you're here and here. Now, so, I mean, it's interesting, but as I said, the thing that I'm really interested in is the distribution of these nodal sets in large dimension. And it turns out that when you write down the volume density, so what do I mean? I mean, you put down all the nodal sets for a harmonic of degree 4, of which there are lots, basically n to the 4. And you put down surface measure on each of these nodal sets, and you integrate. Question is, do you get any sort of, you get asymptotically uniform measure, for instance. And when you do that and you write it down elliptic coordinates, it's precisely these correlations that come out of the volume densities. So understanding the nodal distribution somehow, this is a very important first step. I've not yet been able to prove the result. I have some calculations, but no proofs. But let me just leave with a question. Is the average density of states, meaning exactly what I said, you put down all the nodal sets of degree k, you integrate into this volume measure, does this have an asymptotically uniform distribution on the sphere? So is there a geometric analog to the combinatorial results that I gave earlier in the talk? I think it's promising to work on this. It's, again, because this system mirrors many of these other systems, it's sort of an interesting phenomenon. So I'll stop there.
This is still in the large n limit.
Large n limit. So you take degree 4 harmonics, you look at very high n. You put down all the nodal sets. There are n to the 4 such harmonics.
Somehow the geometry of the sphere in high dimension.
No, well look.
Strange geometry,
because all the volume, for instance, is
contained in.
Yeah, but still, it's not so clear. You
what does uniform distribution mean in that particular limit?
It's an interesting thing. It's not clear.
Right? I guess what he's saying, unless you introduce a notion of discrepancy, uniform distribution almost, we can conceive of, is always in one space.
Yeah.
No. This has
so
no lecture limit.
Space changes on you each time.
Yeah, that's
that
what
happens
I mean.
In random matrix.
Yeah, that's what
so
I mean.
So then the only meaningful thing is some
discrepancy. Yeah, exactly.
And
that's
then,
what I mean.
Then you have only n to the fourth for low degree 2 things in a space that's
Exponentially large.
Yeah, but you can actually let k go to infinity here. It just has to go to infinity.
Yeah,
same
yeah.
Way.
If you let k go to infinity, it's much more chance.
Yeah.
Or if you measure discrepancy relative to
exactly.
Functions, which are very, very smooth, then you know most functions are constant. So it'll look good.
Yeah, that's the point. The high dimensional scales, you get this concentration.
You get this concentration phenomenon, yeah, exactly.
Comes straight out of
Tel
Aviv.
Yeah, exactly.
But you can let k go to infinity here also. I mean, there's
that's
no, yeah, that's, you have to let it go to infinity in tame rate, but you can.
Capital N equals 2.
Yeah.
K goes to infinity. That's
yeah.
Because I can draw a curve.
Yeah.
Are there any other questions?